America always to be a country where someone can become a millionaire. Ronald Clinton. Ronald Clinton on the McNeil Lair. Quote, "This is a free enterprise country," said President Clinton. "I want to create more millionaires in my presidency than Bush and Quayle did." What an ambition. What a goal. He didn't say that. He didn't say that during the campaign. During the campaign, he was Jesse Jackson. When he got into office and started setting up, he was Jimmy Carter. Now he's Ronald Reagan. Now he wants to outdo Bush and Quayle. Presidents describe the overseas investments of giant corporations as U.S. interests. Those giant interests are called U.S. interests abroad to be defended at all costs, certainly at great cost to the U.S. populace. A president's primary commitment abroad is not to democracy, but to free market capitalism. And they are beginning to say that a little more candidly. It's probably not easy for a president to remain keenly aware of the suffering and the travails and the deprivations endured by the great mass of people throughout the world, including a lot of ordinary working people in this country. I mean, the president lives like a monarch, a potentate in utter opulence. He lives in a rent-free 132-room mansion called the White House, set on an 18-acre estate with a personal domestic staff of about 100 people, including 7 butlers and 5 full-time florists, a well-stocked wine cellar, tennis courts, a private movie room, a private gymnasium, a private bowling alley. Lyndon Johnson must have put that one in. And a heated outdoor swimming pool. And this is a guy who's got to pose as a man of the people, who's concerned about ordinary folk. In addition, the president has the free services of a private physician, including all those presidents who didn't want people to have health insurance and socialized medicine, and that would be too much and all that. They should pay for their own medical care. They all had free medical care themselves. See, it's different when you have it for yourself. You understand? It's different. That's what Norman Bradbury is pointing out. It's you out there sacrificing for the country, but I get my family out from downwind. You preach one thing out there, and you do something else. The president also has a dozen chauffeured limousines, numerous helicopters and jets, including Air Force One, and he has access to the imperial luxuries of Camp David and other country retreats, free vacations, a huge expense allowance. And then for those very few things he must pay for out of his own pocket, he gets a salary of $200,000 a year. Journalists and political scientists used to like to write, it was a real fad back in the late 50s, early 60s, I used to describe the presidency as a man-killing job. Well, you know, closer investigation shows that presidents actually probably work a shorter day than the average working man or woman who really has to put in hours. That presidents take more vacations and they live far better and longer than the average American male, including the average middle-class white male. And after leaving office, by the way, they continue to feed off the public trough. 5 ex-presidents we have now, all of them multimillionaires, yet each one receives from $500,000 to $700,000 in annual pensions, office space, staff, and travel expenses, along with full-time Secret Service protection that costs $5 million for each of them. I mean, $5 million for Gerry Ford? Well, is the president too powerful or not powerful enough? Actually, I think both the liberals and conservatives are consistent in both those inconsistent charges. Presidents are not powerful enough when working with mass interests, working for mass interests, I should say, and opposing corporate and financial interests. But the president is very powerful when engaging in the converse, when he's working for corporate interests and when he's working against mass interests. The president is very powerful when he's exercising state power. That whole theory, by the way, when liberals started talking about the imperial presidency, The Republicans hadn't gotten elected yet. There wasn't any Nixon or Ford or Reagan in yet. They were already talking about LBJ, and they were talking about Vietnam. And it occurs to them how irresponsive, unaccountable this power was, as millions of people were saying, get out of this war. And this war, these guys were still going ahead and doing it. And they're saying, my God, this president is an autocrat in a way. Well, on certain kinds of issues, and the closer he is to the state, he is. He suddenly understands that the power of that office was not imbued in the office. The power of that office was there as long as that office served powerful interests. By the way, this is true of Clinton also, what I've just said. What you have here is a structuralist argument. This is the argument of the structuralist versus the functionalist. The structuralists say that the system prefigures what the people can do who go into it. And the functionalists say, no, the people who go in can make a difference. And it's all the question of which guy's in there. Is it a good guy or a bad guy? If it's a good guy, we'll get good policy. If it's a bad guy, we'll get bad policy. The structuralist says that regardless whether it's Tory or Labor, there must still be basic concessions and provisions to those who control the jobs, investments, and market forces, who control the other levers of the state. The structuralist argument is essentially correct, but it's over-applied. Because it's one thing to say that the structure is an inescapable overriding social formation that sets fundamental limits, and it's another thing to say that the structure predetermines all policy outcomes all the time. You can't say that. You get too abstracted, too mystical. I mean, Reagan and Thatcher demonstrated that it does make a difference who's elected. So the functionalists do have a point, that within certain parameters, it does make a difference who's on the Supreme Court, who staffs the departments, who makes decisions in the regulatory agencies and in Congress. It does make a difference. It determines what laws are passed and how they're enforced or how they're ignored.
Party on the Capitol lawn, asking you which side you're on, drawing battle lines in this country. We're a rich nation full of boarded homes, crowded prisons, abandoned schools, poor folks with hard goals, rich folks with poor souls, undereducated and underhomed, underpaid but overloaned, clinging hard to what we own, trying to win the rat race. Oh, so you hate taxes on the working poor, unless, of course, they're for the war or put the wall along the border. But not for nurses or doctors. Priorities flips the way it looks to me, and I work hard as shit for my money. But I don't believe in an economy that forces folks to crawl. Tea party on the Capitol lawn, and Sarah Palin singing along, laughing all the way to the Pentagon. Party on the Capitol lawn, asking you which side you're on, drawing battle lines in this country. Oh, but there's something about our worldview, something about the lens we look through, that keeps us from building something new that works out better for more of us. Well, it's in the cracks where the levees broke, it's in the cash Goldman Sachs stole, it's in the fields of tomatoes where the legacy of slavery roams. It's a hatred born of jealous fear, a hatred born and bred right here, xenophobic and insecure with a deadly outcome. It's a racism that grows and thrives when religion's used to justify an endless list of human rights denied in the name of liberty. Tea party on the Capitol lawn, and the Christian terrorists are singing along, getting ready for the race war. Thank you. should go back home. I say no, the ground that you're standing on. 'Cause Arizona was Mexico and your grandparents were Europeans. And your national heroes like Thomas Paine were immigrants when they came and called themselves Americans. And that's how it's always been. No, Marie and Juan didn't steal your jobs. They were outsourced by Bill and Ron as South America's wealth was robbed by U.S. corporations. So when they dumped the tea in Boston, it was an attack against a corporation. So I don't see the connection between that story and yours. And Crispus Attucks and the Boston Dead weren't fighting for a white nation. They were fighting an occupation like the Iraq and Afghan wars. Tea party on the Capitol lawn, asking you which side you're on, drawing battle lines in this country.
Listen to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was Ryan Harvey with Tea Party. And, of course, we heard from Michael Parenti talking about the nature of the American presidency. Now, one of the things I did, of course, notice, and it's virtually impossible not to notice if you're like in downtown Washington, D.C., you will see the contrast between poverty and opulence pretty clearly. There's a lot of homeless people in downtown Washington, D.C. You see them on the street corners. You see them in the parks. You see, you know, shelters, makeshift shelters that people have built for themselves, just using tarps and, like, you know, all just tents and things like this, like in the parks, like all this sort of thing. And you see that, and then you see the people at these really high-end, you know, diners and, like, restaurants and, like, patios and all this kind of stuff. And they're sitting out there and they're in the suits or, like, in military uniforms. And you can tell, like, they're really top brass in the bureaucracy in Washington, D.C., whether that's military or civilian. And, you know, you see all that money contrasted with total poverty, you know, desperate poverty. A lot of the beggars, of course, are African-American. They're racialized and, you know, a lot of people don't even really know that Washington, D.C. is primarily a African-American city, and there's massive levels of poverty in that city, you know, basically just beyond the beltway, more or less. Like, you basically have slum areas, you know, and that's like the nature of the beast down there. That's like the nature of Washington, D.C. And a lot of where the people, the wealthy people who work on in downtown Washington, D.C. within the beltway, they commute there from basically bedroom communities, like mansions and stuff like that, like in Maryland and in Virginia. You know, like they're on these freeways. They barely even stop. They don't even stop to look at the slum areas, which the majority of Washington really is. You know, it's like that's the kind of thing that we see in D.C. You know, that's really the kind of racial apartheid that exists there. You know, and it's the same kind of thing we see, like, in places like Baltimore. I mean, this is where, like, recently Freddie Gray, like, he's a African-American. He was basically brutalized by the police. He was taken in. He died about a week later in custody. Like, they found out his spine had been severed. You know, and now, you know, basically there's a lot of protests going on in Baltimore. People are standing up. People are trying to fight back against this. You know, I mean, this guy basically was dumped on the floor of a police cell and basically almost left for dead. You know, and of course, you know, then he dies, you know, a week later from this, like, horrific spinal injury, which, you know, cannot be by accident. I mean, like, it was very clearly done deliberately by the cops. And, you know, this is the reality that people face, like, in these places, like down in the States. And I really want to get into that, like, at least a little bit. I want to play some reports from the Real News Network talking about really what's going on in Baltimore surrounding this killing. And it also highlights really what the conditions are like for African Americans in Washington, D.C. as well. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
It's a growing memorial constructed from the remnants of a man's life and death, a man who has come to symbolize one neighborhood's pain and a city's frustration. Residents of Gilmore Homes trying to make something meaningful out of the brief life of Freddie Gray and his death while in police custody. This is where Gray was initially detained, and where he started what would be a slow and painful procession towards death in the back of a police paddy wagon. And while police continued to stonewall on the details surrounding just exactly how Gray's neck was severed from his spine, his community has begun the process of bearing witness to the cross-currents of heavy-handed policing and neglect from City Hall they believe are at the root of his death that has rocked not just the community, but transfixed the nation.
And it's not okay for you to beat our young men like they slaves. You slaughtering them. It's not okay to do that.
Gray died a week after he was arrested. Police say they have no evidence of use of force. Six officers have been suspended, and the Justice Department has joined the investigation. But witnesses from his community say police are not telling the truth.
The paddy wagon was right there. They took the young man out, beat him some more.
Real News Network correspondent Eddie Conaway spoke to the people who were there. One woman described how she saw firsthand what she believes were actions by police that contributed to Gray's death.
The man wasn't responding. They took him by his pants, and he was dragging. Mm-hmm. And I asked them to call the ambulance. They told me to mind my business. Mm-hmm. I told them it is my business.
Another, a blind resident, said he heard Gray pleading for help, which never came.
Now they must have thrown him down. He was hollering, "Come on, you're hurting my back. Get your knee out my back. You're hurting my neck."
The Gilmore Homes Project, where Gray grew up in West Baltimore, bears the scars of neglect. A dilapidated basketball court has sat broken for years. The housing which surrounds it, falling into disrepair. But the decay of the physical infrastructure has not stopped the city from flooding the neighborhood with police, a constant flow of law enforcement that residents told Conway made it impossible to even stand outside in a place where they grew up.
They drive past and we right here, they make us move. And even if we live right here or not, go inside the court. You can't stand here.
They won't let us sit nowhere. They'll tell us move. We got to go here. We got to move off there. We're not doing nothing.
In fact, Gilmore Homes is one of the most heavily policed and incarcerated neighborhoods in the city. The Justice Policy Institute estimates the state spends $17 million annually just to lock up residents of the West Baltimore community, which is why residents say the cycle of neglect and punishment only makes things worse.
Mm-hmm. They had beat my friend up real bad, and they handcuffed me just because I was saying, "Why are y'all beating him like that? Mm-hmm. Why y'all beating him like that?" They put handcuffs on me.
What the fuck y'all expect us to go do when we come home?
Yeah.
We on parole and all that shit. We gonna go there and get to jail. They checking 10 years back, 11 years back, and all that dumb shit. Y'all expect niggas to get a job.
And why the death of Eddie Gray is symbolic in a city where policing and poverty seem inextricably linked. Reporting for the Real News Network, Stephen Janis in Baltimore.
There's a street of eating hawkers. There's a house of hope and drifters. There's a gang that shoots their missiles. Now there's a place that knows no poverty, a town without pollution. There's a soul with good intentions. There are canyons full of movie stars, churches made of metal. There are mountains made of muscle. We have leaders who are anxious. We have captains not courageous. Captains tumbling into madness. But there's a man who makes no enemies. A body never breathless. No ambition ever hopeless. Up on Balaam Bridge somebody is waiting. Up on Balaam Bridge I'm shot to heaven. Up on Bedlam Bridge, waiting. In these locked and shackled neighborhoods, bridge and tunnel diplomats see the golden ghetto's creeper.
crazy flags for history. Songs for the White House gangsters, guns for Hellgate and railway sleepers. But there's a man who makes no enemies, a body never breathless, no ambition ever hopeless. So how stands the city on this winter's night? The city on a hill, so they said. The snow is falling down around the armory, and the city's closing in around my head. Up on Bedlam Bridge, somebody is waiting. Up on Bedlam Bridge, I've shot to heaven. Oh, up on Bedlam Bridge, I'm waiting. Somebody's waiting. Up on Bedlam Bridge, I'm shot to heaven. Oh, up on Bedlam Bridge, I'm waiting. I'm shot to heaven.
We can bring it down.
Oh, oh, up on Bedlam Bridge, I'm waiting. Drive, drive, drive.
Tensions between police and the community are fraught in Baltimore as the anger over the death of Freddie Gray while in police custody enters its fifth day on Thursday with protests planned citywide, beginning at City Hall at 3 p.m. State troopers were dispatched to the city and workers were encouraged to leave downtown prior to the protest start. With no word from city officials on the status of the investigation into the details of the West Baltimore man whose spine was severed while in police custody, protesters say their efforts are just beginning.
I go home and cry every night because of shit like this. Because of people like you who won't cross the line for people like me. For people like yourself, for people like your daughter. For people like...
But as tensions mount, police appear to be beginning to push back. The video shows police detaining 17-year-old Michaela Price after she climbed a barricade outside of the city's Western District headquarters yesterday evening.
34 units.
Dominique Stevenson, also at the protest, explains why she decided to join Price.
Of the fact that I knew that Michaela was a minor, and I was very concerned with how the police themselves would treat her based on the tensions between the police and the crowd.
What happened next?
Actually, what happened next was I turned around and looked to see if other people were going to commit civil disobedience, and they didn't. They basically took us in my case, kind of roughly. We got inside and we didn't receive a summons. We don't go to court. They essentially gave us like a written warning. I don't expect folks from that particular neighborhood to put themselves on the line because then they'll have to deal with the retaliation. But I think that there are those of us who, one, don't have warrants, who don't have a criminal history, who should be putting more on the line if we say that we really stand in solidarity with these folks. And I also think that it's a new day. Young people don't want to hear what many of us have been hearing for the last 30 or 40 years. They really want significant change, and they do believe that that's going to come by shutting these systems down.
Talked about police brutality, and so physical manifestations of oppression in these neighborhoods, but it runs much deeper than that. It runs into the very fabric of the priorities of what gets funded in these neighborhoods and what programs get funded, whether it's incarceration or basketball courts or schools. And so talk about that, because one of the factors that's part of this.
Sure. Even in talking to young men on the street from that community, the main thing they're saying is like, look, there are no jobs here. There are no jobs. There's no economic development. We've worked for a year to be allowed to get a volunteer to redo a basketball court and have run into red tape there, you know, with the City Housing Authority. There's very little recreation for young people. They talk about being harassed by the police simply walking out of their doors. It's like, it's a setup. It's a setup, and there needs to be change. And also, we have to move beyond the demonstrations and the protests. We really have to work with the community and do the necessary organizing in that community. And it means being present. Folks run out of food stamps. They're living in dire situations. We need to, you know, those of us that have resources, few that it may be, have to be willing to share those resources and work with people in the community to address those problems.
So there's national, international media here for something that happens every day in Baltimore. What's your take on how the media has covered it? And, you know, some would say that the only thing that's different about Freddie Gray was that it was caught, what happened to him was caught on tape, and that has galvanized people around the city. But so what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that the way that some of the media are dealing with the community is very intrusive. It's good that these folks are having their voices heard. That's very important. But the way that, even with CNN, the way that they presented the arrest yesterday, they really didn't present it. You see the crowd in a shot that looks like they're raging at the police. You know, and so I think that there's still that bias on the part of the media. They're here because of the fact that this is a nationwide issue. It's blown up in the last year. So they're here, but the way that they're in the community is very intrusive. And it's not, I mean, how can they walk around these communities and not see the poverty and not connect the issues to Freddie Gray's death and policing and mass incarceration?
I know a man who hates unions, even though he's in a union, and the wage he gets from being union gave him what he's got. He lives life quite nicely with a big house and a family, and he seldom has to worry about paying all his bills. Yes, the power he got from his union card and his free time born from union blood gave him a happy life. I know a woman who hates the poor, cause she's scared herself of being poor, and she hates how it's so close to her from where she's at right now. She hangs through life on a thin thread, and the pundits offer her hatred to make her feel like she's elevated above somebody else. But she knows, and I know, she's right there in the shadows with all the somebody else's. You can look like this, raised hard by the mist of whiteness, clinging with a tightness to a violent racist past. The deck from which your hands are dealt is that centuries deep in cotton wealth, and the stories that your people tell are those of hope and pain. We got angry men who are raised deprived, emotionally traumatized, whose way of dealing with the world outside is rage or to block it out. And women working most of their lives unappreciated by the men in their lives, who know what it means to feel alive because they know what it means to hurt. Ignorance bred from despair, that's what we got here. America, you can look like this, raised hard by the mist of whiteness, clinging with a tightness to a violent racist past. Well, the deck from which your hands are dealt is stacked centuries deep in cotton wealth, and the stories that your people tell are those of hope and pain. my parents who worked hard, and they taught me how to work hard. But a lot of people work hard and don't get what they deserve. And so it was early on that I learned which side I'm on. The one that fights for human rights in a world of dollar signs. Well, you can call that radical, but I just call it practical, you know. You can look like this, raised high by the mists of whiteness, clinging with a tightness to a violent racist past, but that ain't gonna last.
Welcome to the Real News Network. I'm Sharmini Perez coming to you from Baltimore, where protests are continuing after yet another death in police custody. Freddie Gray, a 25-year-old African-American Baltimore resident, died a week after his arrest. Officials have launched a criminal probe into his death, but Maryland's Police Bill of Rights stipulates that only police can investigate police. The Gray family has called for a federal civil rights investigation into the killing because they said they fear that the police are covering up his death. Ongoing killings and brutality against African Americans has the black community organizing and raising many questions of who controls law enforcement in this country. Now joining us to discuss this is Glenn Ford. Glenn has just returned from Black is Back Coalition's National Conference on Black Community Control of Police in St. Louis. Thank you so much for joining us, Glenn.
Thank you for the opportunity.
So, Glenn, I hope you've come back with the major solution to this problem.
Well, black community control of police is the, the democratic solution to the problem. The problem that black people have with the police is black people don't have a power and the police are not accountable to them. So black community control of the police is the logical solution. And that's what that conference in St. Louis was about this weekend. When you talk about Ferguson, you're really talking about a greater black St. Louis population. Ferguson's one of those small towns that now have large black populations as a spillover from very, very black North St. Louis, which is where the conference was held. The conference had the deep involvement and heard the searing testimony from many, many mothers and fathers and sisters and brothers of the victims of police oppression in black America, not just from St. Louis, but from all across the country. All of them saw the logic and endorsed the logic of black community control of the police. One of the reasons I think this was such a successful conference is that elements of the Black is Back Coalition, which is comprised of lots of groups, elements of the coalition back in January convened a Black People's Grand Jury in Ferguson, which brought a people's indictment against Officer Darren Wilson for murder in the death of Michael Brown. And of course, that is part of the general demand for black community control of the police. It's not just that this police army of occupation makes life miserable for black folks. It's the whole U.S. criminal justice system, which includes prosecutors and the courts. And we have to devise ways to sever ourselves from that hostile matrix and complex of power to the extent that we can. The central message of the conference.
This is Radio Truth, a series of commentaries by Dr. Michael Parenti. Michael Parenti is an activist and internationally known award-winning author and scholar. His recent books include the assassination of Julius Caesar.
You're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph. 250 watts of community power.
Once again, the Guelph Resource Center for Gender Empowerment and Diversity is hosting a WENDO self-defense workshop for all self-identified women. This course teaches awareness and avoidance, as well as verbal and physical self-defense techniques. Course content and location are survivor-friendly and wheelchair accessible. While usually $150, this course is being offered for only $45, or $35 if you register before April 25th. The course itself is 9:30 to 5 on Saturday and Sunday, May 9th and 10th. Register in person at the UC Info Desk at the University of Guelph or online at wendo.bpt.me. Visit us at Kirkhead in UC 107 and help yourself to a free cup of tea while you're there. Stay fierce, stay bold, stay safe.
Aerobics. Gonna stretch your mind.
Your life.
Tuesday morning. Seven to nine. CFRU 93.3.
God Made Me Funky is back with their new album, Funky, Fly, and Free, featuring the songs Jaded Glass, Digital Life, and the uptown banging new single, So Complicated. Check out the nation's premier retro electro new funk party band on tour this summer. God Made Me Funky's new album, Funky, Fly, and Free, is available now on CD and digitally. Hit them up on Twitter and Instagram for their free weekly online swag contest. And check out GodMadeMeFunkyBand.com.
Convened a Black People's Grand Jury in Ferguson, which brought a people's indictment against Officer Darren Wilson for murder in the death of Michael Brown. And of course, that is part of the general demand for Black community control of the police. It's not just that this police army of occupation makes life miserable for Black folks. It's the whole U.S. criminal justice system, which includes prosecutors and the courts. And we have to devise ways to sever ourselves from that hostile matrix and complex of power to the extent that we can. The central message of the conference was that the problem, as we said, is a problem of power. That is, Black people are not killed in such horrific numbers by the police because the police are badly trained. They're not killed because police don't have body cameras or other technical fixes. They're killed because Black people have no power in their own communities, or those communities are run by people who are accountable to folks outside of the communities. So this conference, and I'm sure that when it's replicated across the country, as it will be, firmly was adamant that when people come up with these diversionary proposals, these pseudo solutions to the problem, and that includes just the hiring of more Black cops, and of course it includes stuff like amorphous sensitivity training, the response has to be that Black folks demand control of the police that are in their community. There was a working group within the coalition that drew up sample legislation that could be used for resolutions by local city councils to demand Black community control. And there are parts of that resolution that geographically delineate what where the Black community is. You can't just say Black community control without saying what are the boundaries there. So that's the kind of thinking and working that's already underway. There are petitions that have been formed nationally demanding Black community control of the police. It was certainly by acclamation accepted that there should be universal cop watching. That is, everybody ought to be watching and videotaping the cops, making a record of their behavior. After all, that is how the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense began back in 1966 in Oakland, California. They were a cop watch, and they identified the police as an army of occupation in the Black community, and it was true then, and it's true now, and Black folks are responding finally to that reality.
Now, Glenn, describe for us more what that looks like in terms of a model for policing, controlling the police.
Well, it can have many different ways of coming into being. The conference was very, very careful not to try to make some kind of cookie-cutter approach to black community control of police. And there's a basic reason that you cannot do that. None of this comes about through the proceduralisms of our bourgeois go to the polls every 2 or 4 years to vote democracy. We're talking about a confrontation with the state as it now exists. And everybody who's an activist understands that the openings that need to be made involve the seizure of power by people on the ground, the creation of crises that are so difficult, so painful for the rulers to bear that they will agree to proposals that would have been unthinkable before. And so the nature of these crises as they develop, crises that are inevitable because, as you said at the beginning of this story, the police, like clockwork, just keep on doing their murderous job, that by definition, these conditions in various localities will be different at different times and different places, and there will be different openings. Some crises will be more prone to spontaneous violence than others. In other places, organized groups of people working quite out in the open in large numbers can help create the creative crisis that forces the rulers to respond to a righteous demand for black community control of police. There's no formula for this. But what we do know is that the black community has been radicalized in a fantastically short period of time. I mean, it's not a year since August 9th when Michael Brown was shot down in Ferguson. We have not gone through a whole summer season under this this new mentality and attitude in the black community, this radicalization. So we don't know how things are going to develop, but we do know that when these situations present themselves and people seize the time, those of us who are organized need to be ready to talk about what these solutions should be. And the solution is power to control the police or replace and displace the police in our communities.
Glenn, as always, thank you so much for joining us. Just back from the Black is Back Coalition. Thank you, Glenn.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us on the Real News Network.
Welcome home, comrades. Welcome home. Woo. Welcome home, Marshal Eddie Conway. Welcome home, Tunziata Akoli. Welcome
home. Take your sacrifice.
Welcome home, Sekou Ojeda.
Take your sacrifice. Cause you don't know if it's an afterlife. If it's an afterlife. Take your sacrifice.
I live for today, no time to play, and got no time for no games. Remembering the song when I'm dead and I'm gone, bury me dead in the flames. Make them remember your names, taking your claim in this lifetime. Nothing to lose, everything to gain. And it's rightfully mine, Matulu Shakur opened the door and took me up under his wing. I sat at the table, drank from the ladle, now I got something to bring. Salute to the youth that walk with the truth, I'm ready to give their stripes. You're never too young, remember their hungers, now they're giving the strikes. Bobby Hutton, yeah, Bobby Hutton, I say it again and again. First to join, first to die, independent for self-defense. 15 years old, the brother was cold, he had the heart of 1,000 men. Long live his name, I think about him when I train. So now we gon' win. Fred said don't never be scared, cause you too young to die. Cause you feel you already did, now I'm just paralyzed. Don't tell me your destiny, take the future into your hands. If anyone can do it, then you can. Take your sacrifice. Take your sacrifice. Cause you don't know if it's an afterlife. If it's an afterlife. Take your sacrifice. Take your sacrifice. Cause you don't know if it's an afterlife. If it's an afterlife.
It's so serious, yeah. It's so serious. Emergency is cardiac arrest. If you thuggin', then you better wear a vest. This is the reality is yeah. The test. Twyma Meyer set him on fire, he was down with the BLA. He was 16 when he picked his team and sacrifice was made. When I say sacrifice, I don't mean to do nothing stupid. Participation is the best education, say Huey Newton. Scared money don't make no money, that's what they say in them streets. And victory is so sweet versus the agony of defeat. I'd rather down my knees and live as a coward up in these streets. And dying, let's stop dying, if you with it then let's get free. The youth brigade ever so brave, never get led to the slaughter. The next to change the future, we the best of the sons and daughters. My back to the wind, my feet to the ground, I'm putting it down for my crown. But not no colony, fuck with my philosophy, that's what I'm about. I learned from the Palestinians and the Mexican EZLN. The government that's down with imperialism can't be your friend. They bad boy politicians saying show me the Benjamins. But I'm throwing up RBG until the end. Take your sacrifice. Take your sacrifice. Cause you don't know if it's an afterlife. If it's an afterlife. Take your sacrifice. Take your sacrifice, cause you don't know if it's an afterlife. If it's an afterlife. Yeah. Do this for my jewel and my gem. Those are my daughters, I do it for them. I did it before and I do it again. I sacrifice again and again. Everything I have and own, through them my legacy lives on. For every day a child is born, a soul is taken, passing on. Sacrifice to sacrifice, life is like coal and ice. I give my last bag of rice, cause you will not starve tonight. You will not die of hunger. All my life put me under the jail. Lose the key like George Jackson did for me. Troy Davis, I'm Troy Davis, I say it again and again. He was murdered on death row like many innocent men. When I say innocent, I mean innocent, never proved too much doubt. When they can't take your dignity, they try to take you out. I offer this sacrifice of blood, food, and rum, and need me to all the dead till the ceremony's done. Jonathan Jackson, Lolita LeBron, and Young Lord Shacha Jimenez, they all sacrifice their lives for us to take be here present. Take your sacrifice. Take your sacrifice. Cause you don't know if it's an afterlife. If it's an afterlife. Take your sacrifice. Take your sacrifice, cause you don't know if it's an afterlife. If it's an afterlife. When the revolution comes, black cultural centers will be forts, supplying revolutionaries with food and arms when a revolution comes. Speak not of revolution until you are willing to eat rats to survive.
This is Radio Truth, a series of commentaries by Dr. Michael Parenti. Michael Parenti is an activist and internationally known award-winning author and scholar. His recent books include The Assassination of Julius Caesar and Super Patriotism. His latest book, The Culture Struggle, is now available. For further information, please visit his website, michaelparenti.org.
The Phony War on Crime. More than a half century ago, Dwight Eisenhower campaigned his way into the White House on a platform that promised to fight communism, crime, and corruption. In all the years that followed, political office holders have heaped praise upon themselves for tirelessly waging a war on crime and a war on drugs, outdoing each other in trying to appear tough on this issue. Police and prison budgets skyrocketed, as did prison populations, the latter consisting heavily of nonviolent drug offenders serving draconian sentences. Under such bombardments, public fear about crime accelerated far more precipitously than the actual crime rate. Today, America is a nation feeling itself under siege from its criminal element. It's a land of gated communities, heavily guarded apartment towers, and millions of households armed with guns ready to dispatch unidentified trespassers. Fear of crime is supplemented with fear of ethnic minorities, terrorists, immigrants, foreigners, gays, feminists, rampaging teenagers, and outspoken peace protesters in what amounts to a generalized culture of fear. Menacing images are implanted in our brains during our most imaginative and malleable years. In the United States, millions of children spend thousands of hours in front of the TV every year, ingesting a steady diet of violence-ridden programs. By the time the average teenager is graduated from high school, he or she will have witnessed about 13,000 TV killings and many times that number of assaults, fistfights, robberies, shootouts, rapes and attempted rapes. A survey by the National Institute of Mental Health found that the level of fear among children increases with heavy TV viewing. Very young children, unable to grasp the motives behind the violence, tend to see almost everyone on television as involved in a universal mode of brutality and threat. And not just children. Adults, too, ingest a steady diet of shows that feature every known violent act. Deranged murderers terrorize train passengers. Kidnappers torment and kill their captives. Terrorized women careen around in their homes, stalked by determined intruders. Vampires slurp the blood of trembling maidens. Ghoulish maniacs massacre people with chainsaws, and on and on. After enough days, months, and years of consuming this kind of fare, we might well be ready to vote for authoritarian law and order candidates, support the death penalty, increase military spending, bomb Iraq, buy a gun, and shoot anybody who strolls across our lawn after dusk. In the thriller films pitched to both young and older audiences, the basic paradigm is roughly the same. The world is swarming with fearsome aggressors who want to do us in. Virtuous Americans are menaced by evil foreigners, communists, cutthroats, diabolic geniuses, screaming savages, alien space invaders, giant asteroids, slimy serpentine creatures from beneath the lagoon, murderous mutant microbes, and other natural and supernatural perils. In these films, the ordinary people seem unable to defend themselves through collective action. Their role is to run hither and thither, screaming to be saved from the menace. And saved they are, after suffering enough casualties, by individual heroes or state authorities who use generous applications of firepower to make everything nice again. Good guys and their enemies never get together to negotiate a peaceful settlement. They only meet to go at each other's throats. Fed a lifelong diet of such offerings, many Americans have little difficulty accepting the picture painted by our leaders of a world full of vicious adversaries, lurking within and without our borders, just waiting to pounce upon us. These malefactors can only be deterred by more police, more prisons, more repressive laws, more military spending, more and huge military establishment, and more wars. This is the great crime hype. And this is Michael Parenti for Radio Truth.
This commentary was produced by the LA Sound Posse.
I can feel the city breathing. I can feel the city breathing. Just even. I can feel the city breathing.
The city breathe right, she need detox. 8 o'clock traffic block, the kids coughing black. Snot blood clot, billboard talking nonsense. Apartment get robbed, the content shit's tense. While the rents increase, minimum wage stays a piece of feces / treason. Can't breathe easy, concrete reachy. East, west, north, south, to connect your house to some tower of some company power. Acid shower, thousands of born rare deformity. Suburban golf course, four course feast. City eats it, breathes shit in her condition, leaking in, seeping through the cracks she passed. It's concrete and steel advance.
She's barely breathing.
Yes, the flesh on the
it's a wheezing gas. City collapses. The city collapses.
In the architecture, the city center set off sensors. This mention of violence and cab drivers ride like theme park. It's only ever dark or sharp as light, like night, life, light. And kids are high as kites, fucking or fighting. Night vulture, more walking, new macho, got a Glock, heart tarmac, lot reflector. Heat off and it makes us nauseous from fumes and toxins. And you can
thank the sponsor for making it all possible.
She's barely breathing.
Against the flesh,
it's a wheezing gas bleed through the steel and the glass, saying the city collapses.
How can we resist?
The city collapses.
Against the flesh of the demon, demon, demon. Just even against the flesh of the demon. I can feel the city breathing.
My word act like nominally got rhymingly packed. Punch, crash the fun by metric tons. And plus my math, distribute cash among the classes. Take from the thieving greedy bastard. Give back like church has to get past. Collapse structure, fuck facades. I destruct the support beams and bars. Wrecking ball large, resistance. Subversive bitch, y'all. Flip the shit just like a brick throne. Dethrone kings, bring the trees on. My tone rock like Gibraltar pop. Hip hop hotter than a rocket shot. I'm crime, think, fuck, bring the big dog. Teach you to flee from the flock, walk off. Switch shit, hit my target. Drop like bombs in the form of carpets. I got the target locked on now, aw shit. Pump your fist if you know what we on. That's a rap. Boom, bap, original rap at. Take it back. Boom, bap, boom, bap. I'm talking true path, master the craft. The pupil, the prof, keep dropping math. Boom, bap, blast the bazooka rap.
Boom, bap, original rap.
My name is Bahmuda, and you are listening to CFRU 93.3 FM.
For your own pleasure, a well-hidden treasure, Pizza Chocadero. We serve delicious gourmet pizza with daily made dough, homemade sauce, and fresh toppings cut by hand. Ask us for our 2-1 special. Pizza Chocadero, open weekdays till 9, weekends until 10. Located at 7 Municipal, north of College in Edinburgh. Proud to be an independent family-owned business. Call 519-829-2444 or visit trocadero.ca.
The 29th annual Guelph and District Multicultural Festival happens June 5th through 7th at Riverside Park. This accessible festival showcases the region's diverse cultural heritage and spirit over a three-day family-friendly event that's free to everyone to attend. This year, once again, we kick off the festival Friday night with our traditional outfits parade, followed by our very popular Latin night in the food tent. Main stage performances happen all weekend long, as well as side performances in our food tent, children's tent, and youth tents. Our popular networking tent is back, plus we have over 25 craft vendors, 20 food vendors, and the Highland Games continues, this time with the special CrossFit Games on Saturday afternoon. This and so much more is all free. Volunteers are needed for all aspects of the festival, so if you're interested, give us a shout at info@gdmf.ca or find out more information on the festival, which again happens June 5th through 7th at Riverside Park at gdmf.ca.
Put your finger on the groove with Planet Groove every Friday between 10 a.m. and 11 a.m. for some soul-stirring funk.